Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. I wanted to talk today about the repeal and replacement Obamacare congressional bill that's being, deliberated at this point. It keeps changing. And it's a really complicated situation, and it affects everybody. And I've been on a lot of interviews recently, and it's just the fear of the unknown. I don't know if you know this, Dave, but I just got back yesterday from Washington. I'm a member of Physicians Council on Healthcare Policy, and it's a group of doctors all across the country, independent academic doctors who've gone up to speak with congressmen about what we believe needs to be done to help this our healthcare system. And it was an eye-opening experience. I think the last time I was on the show, I talked about what I thought was wrong with the bill, and so I wanted to revisit this because information changes. I mean, I know you're probably as confused as everybody else is about what's going on, right?
You know, between confused and frustrated, yes, to answer your question. You know, it seems like for the last eight and a half years now, we get a lot of smoke and mirrors and a lot of just talk. It's like there used to be a guy on Ed Sullivan that would come on. He was a comedian, and he would just talk but never say anything. I don't know if you remember that or not, but he could, you know, just go on and on and on. And you'd sit there and listen, and he was saying words, but they were totally disconnected. And that's sort of the way I feel about Congress.
Well, I understand that. That's a reasonable feeling to have, because it does feel like nothing moves. And so let's go back to what went on in the last 8 years, that there was absolute gridlock. So as we know, the Democrats, before the election, had control of basically Congress. And every time the Republicans put through a repeal bill, one, it never got through, and two, it never would have been signed off by the president. So it was an exercise in futility. And I think, like most people, everybody assumed that as soon as the administration changed and the Republicans took control of the House and the Senate, it would be the easiest thing to do to just push through all their repeal efforts and have something on the agenda to replace it with. That would be a logical assumption. I'm sure that's what you thought would happen as well, right?
Sure. No doubt.
Yeah, no doubt, exactly. So, I mean, I think part of this is messaging. Part of it is the fact that there are significant members in the Congress that don't want things to change. And the other part is the actual makeup and the rules and regulations in Congress, which are completely ridiculous. So after going up there this week, one of the things that is clear, which never was, is that you have to have... The way Harry Reid fixed this, I mean, you can have 51 votes for reconciliation. And basically what that means is you can pass things, but they can't change the budget. So you can't legislate in that environment, and you can't add monies to whatever legislation you're going to change. So by definition, repealing it won't work. You don't have enough votes. You need 60 votes to do that. In the Senate, which I didn't know. So it kind of makes sense that now to me, but you just can't get rid of it and just replace it completely because there's too many hurdles to get there. So they might be able to do it in the House, but then it would fail the Senate because they don't have enough people. Now, could they talk some Democrats into doing it? Perhaps, but you'd have to talk a heck of a lot. Could they put pressure on them in terms of whether they get back in on the next round of elections in a couple of years? Maybe, but you want something done now, right? That's what everybody wants. This thing needs to end. It's crushing people. It's taxing people to death. It's bankrupt. It's not working on any level. So that's the one hurdle that's the unknown that nobody knows when they talk about it on TV. You just can't repeal it, even though it's been said. It's not really, it's not feasible. So what this bill is, it's a three-part plan. It's three prongs to it, apparently. The first is to change how it's funded. Apparently there's money out there that the Republicans over the past 8 years have taken out of the Obamacare pot, so it can't be used for Obamacare. So if this bill takes that money, you know, brings it back into the pot, so to speak, and then it gets, it decides how it's allocated. So in other words, health savings accounts is going to allow people to increase their payment into their health savings account. It gets rid of the mandate, which I think is the best part of it, frankly. It gets rid of now all of the taxes. Well, initially it didn't. So let's talk about the Ryan initial plan, which nobody liked, and for good reason. It didn't get rid of all the taxes because it, one, it took 2 years, I think, before anybody would see the tax removal, and it still kept the Cadillac tax. And what that meant is those people with the PPO plans, the ones where you can go to see any doctor you like, where you pay a lot for it, but you get more benefits because of it, they were going to sack it with a 25% surcharge, which would price most people out of the good plans and push them into the HMO Medicaid pot, which is, I think, the whole, as we discussed for years and years now, the whole point of Obamacare was not for it to succeed. It was to create a total disaster that the answer would eventually be single payer. So in order to get that, you had to make everybody basically unhappy, destitute, and then beg the government for help, and bam, you'd have Medicare for all, which in actuality is really Medicaid for all. It's not even Medicare for all. So that's the underlying argument for why it can't be repealed, why it's being done in such a piecemeal fashion. And, you know, I get it now, which I didn't get before. What we really want, you know, what we went up there to discuss with the Congress folks are, how can we make this free market friendly? This situation right now is still very much geared to insurance companies. Yes, it has some good stuff. If you don't like your insurance right now, you can leave it. You won't be, Obamacare, I mean, you won't be taxed. You won't be fined. That's a good thing because it lets people out of a system that doesn't work well for them. If they can't afford the premiums, they can't afford the coinsurance and deductibles, they're free. So from that standpoint, at least you're not being held captive anymore to pay for something that you don't want. In that regard, the sooner you can do that, bring it on, the better. So they got rid of in the second iteration of this, obviously the conservatives weren't happy because it didn't really do enough for conservative values. So I don't know if you know this, but they inserted into Medicaid, if states want people to have a caveat in order to get Medicaid, you have to work if you're able-bodied, that was inserted. I don't really have a problem with that. If you're able-bodied and you're able to work and you can find a job, I think that's reasonable for you to have that as a underpinning for you receiving benefits. But they did take out, which was in, the ability for the Homeland Security and the Congress basically to know who's getting these benefits. So if you're not here legally, you still can get health care paid for by everybody else, which that just got stripped out recently. So it's one of those things where you get one, give you one hand, take away with the other. And that's why I think this thing is getting hung up, because people are inserting things, taking things out, when they should just be above board about the whole thing. I mean, did you know any of that stuff was going on?
No.
I know, it's really complicated.
Yeah, and you know, that's what's frustrating. You know, unfortunately, the Secretary of Home and Human Resources now, you know, gave me a little sidebar lecture on, well, Dave, you know, if you're going to, you got to go along to get along in D.C. You know, mm-hmm. I'm so sick of that you don't even want to get me started. And this is what's wrong with the swamp, is it? Well, Dr. George, I like what you say, and I'll be glad to support it, Dr. George. If you'll just support my little deal about, you know, everybody gets a free cigar on Monday morning. But I'll go along with you if you know, you. Mine's a little request, so will you go along with me? And that's exactly what's happening, and that's what's wrong up there, in my opinion.
I agree, but you have to work within the rules at this point. I mean, the sell is, if you get this thing through the Senate and it comes back and gets signed into law, then all of the legislative side of it can kick in. And let's backtrack. The Health and Human Services, the czar, this is the only good thing about keeping Obamacare and not repealing it completely. I mean, let me be clear. My first recommendation would be to repeal this crap, get it out, and actually put in new legislation that puts in all the things that will bend the cost curve and people can be informed consumers. That would be my first choice. But I'm not up there. I mean, I'm not running the show. So in the absence of that, and we'll discuss what I think would be the best way to go about it at the end, I guess. But right now, what you have to do, it's like not like Nancy Pelosi, you have to pass to find out what's in it. I don't believe that at all. But you have to actually get this thing off the ground. I mean, it's like the argument was, do you want 100% of nothing or do you want 80% of something? That's how my pragmatic mind has had to come to deal with this. Because ultimately, I want people not to have to pay a fine. I don't want a mandate. I don't want the government to tell me or anybody in the country, this is how you have to do it. And if you don't like it, tough. That's just not right. So if we're in a position where this thing gets passed, then you can start putting in all of the meat of what we wanted. But let's back up. Sorry, I'm digressing. Because it's not repealing Obamacare completely, the only thing that we have in our back pocket, which I think is the reason they didn't want Congressman Price to get in there, is that the HHS secretary is a czar. He has the ultimate power to remove and replace and write rules and regulations in Obamacare. So if he is able to go through every single line of that law and take out all the things that are harmful to patients, there is no congressional oversight on that. He just gets to do it. That's probably the fastest way to gut this thing, to insert language that's friendly to doctors and patients, and just completely cut the middleman, meaning Congress, lobbyists, out. So the fact that you now have a doctor who practiced medicine, who was a small businessman, who actually understands how this crap was written and can actually gut it quickly, that is the actual, to me, the saving grace of not repealing and fighting and taking years to get to the end point of this and making a fast forward to getting to what we want. So it's not that easy, but if you keep your eye further down, you know, on the prize, I think we'll get what we want faster if we play ball at this point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Can you get that point across to the people that need to hear it and make sense with it?
Well, I'm hoping that's what we did when we went up there this past weekend, right? So there's a lot of ideas, free market ideas that doctors are all in favor of. And I think we got the ear of the people who are going to craft the new legislation, the changes that are going to come online. And I guess we need to take a break, and we'll discuss more of that when we come back. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. This morning I'm trying to break down the repeal process, the writing of the new law that's supposed to replace Obamacare, and why it's not as easy and as simple as we all want it to be. I mean, another thing that they're doing in the new law is they are allowing people who have the Affordable Care Act now to keep it unchanged for the next 2 years. So all the rhetoric that we're hearing about, oh, it's going to throw people off and people, they want people to die and so on and so forth, is totally not true. But that 24 million people that the CBO says are going to be off, you know, not have insurance, Those are the people who don't like it now, who can't afford it, and now are free to stop being gouged and leave it. That's not unhappy people, for the most part, I don't believe. It doesn't make sense, right? So the people who like it can keep it. They don't have to have any change for 2 years. That gives us enough time for the market forces, which I think if they're left alone, will become the competition to this crony, monopoly-driven, expensive, artificial system that the insurance companies have created, and the government for that matter. So if we're allowing, and we talked about it before, direct primary care, direct pay practices, medical cost sharing like Samaritan, Liberty Health Share, to thrive, which they are doing, that puts pressure, and then the transparency of those systems, where you can go online, know exactly what it costs to get a CT, a tonsillectomy, a gallbladder surgery, everything's listed in the private side. It's going to force the people in the hospitals, the hospital-driven practices, to play ball or go out of business. Because once people know how much something is, and you ask the other side and they tell you, I don't know, who in their right mind would use that system? That's the fear of all of this from the crony side, from the status quo in our healthcare system. They are, it's like a, you know, sunlight to a vampire, really. Once people are empowered to make conscious healthcare decisions with their pocketbook, with their own money, they will make the proper decisions. The problem is that's been ripped away from people over the past 15, 20 years. And it's wrong, but it's for a reason. It's empowered and enriched all of these healthcare entities. It's a complete, it's like a monster. You've gone from just having the doctor and the patient making deals with each other, knowing what the prices are up front, to an insurance company coming in and paying for the big ticket items, which I don't have an issue with, if it's going to be, you know, $10,000 or more, whatever, and you want help, then you should buy insurance to get that. More power to you. But what they've managed to do is literally encroach into the doctor's office, into the patient's pocket, and say, you know what, we'll take over, we'll pay for everything, trust us. But we did. And what did they do? They've taken complete advantage of both sides of us. They're charging patients $1,000, $1,300 in premiums just for the privilege of carrying a card. Then they tack on out-of-pocket costs, something called cost shifting, where you now pay, if you're lucky, you have $500. I don't see that very much anymore. It's more like $1,500, $2,500, $7,500, $10,000 more out-of-pocket in order to use your health insurance. And to top it all off, they have gatekeeping going on where you have to ask for permission. May I? And they'll say, sure, in some instances, and then deny you after you've had it done. Or they'll say, no, it's not medically necessary. It's experimental. Things that have been going on for 50 years are now experimental because they don't want to pay out. They make their profit on you buying a premium and then you not using it. That's how they roll. So they've been empowered with this system to do that on steroids while they continue to cry poor, while they continue to say we need more freebies. It's ridiculous. And that's the one thing that I don't know if it's out of this bill, but I sure hope that it's legislated out that the insurance companies will get a 30% surcharge for people who don't carry insurance for over 63 days. That's ridiculous. That's giving insurance companies, suppose you're healthy, you had nothing wrong with you. Why would you have to pay a 30% surcharge just to carry insurance? Things like that just kill the bill, in my opinion, or make it less powerful, or make it not change the problem. And I'm sorry I went around a long way to get to the point, but I just want people to understand this is a really complex situation. And it doesn't have to be, but if it were the doctors and patients doing this, it wouldn't be. But it's all of these vested interests who have more voice, more power on Capitol Hill, at least in the short term. They have it now, but we have the ability to take it back. Doctors, by not playing in this system and removing themselves from insurance panels, educating their patients about what the true costs are, if they have the ability to stay independent and not sell their practice to hospitals, and the patients have the power by making conscious consumer-driven choices. If it's too expensive, I want to find a cheaper alternative. I'm not just going to do what you want me to do just because you say, do I have to take the medication? Do I really need it? I have a patient who came into my office last week, young, healthy guy, comes in with a totally different problem, and on his medication list, he's on a cholesterol-lowering drug. And so I asked him, you know, what is your cholesterol? It was normal. Do you have a family history of heart disease? No. Stroke? No. Have you ever had any kind of cardiac issue? No. I'm like, well, why are you on the medication? Because my doctor recommended that I should do it preemptively. This is the mindset that patients need to start. Do your own diligence. You are the captain of your own ship. Why are you allowing someone to put you on a medication? One, you don't know why, and two, you don't need. Do you know how much cost that is to the healthcare system? You know, it's all the choices that patients make as well, and doctors. We need to take responsibility for having this system get completely out of control. No one's going to tell me to put any poison in my body. And that's what medication is. It's a controlled poison. It's a controlled toxin. Sometimes you need it. Sometimes you don't. The question is, you need to ask your doctor, do I really need this? Is there another way around this? Is there some lifestyle change I can make so I don't have to take it? Instead of just, you know, opening your mouth and shoving pills in, and it just drives me crazy when people don't know what they're on. They don't know why they're on it. I'm like, that doesn't make sense to me. So unless patients actually change their routines and their habits, and quite frankly, take their power back, this is a system that will continue unabated. You know, why are these drugs so high? This question that people ask, but do they do anything about it? Like, I don't want to take $10,000 worth of medication a month if I don't have to. You know, that's the mindset, and it needs to change.
Dr. George, pardon me. I'd like to regress, if you don't mind, just a little bit. I would like to see in this new bill or in the replacement, I was just sitting here wondering how many of your people that listen to the show, either live or on podcasts, would off the cuff know what EOB is. I know you and I know what it is. And
right.
It's my opinion that the insurance companies should provide you an EOB at the front end instead mm-hmm. of at the back end. Wouldn't that make more sense?
That's called price transparency. And, you know, your insurance company, before you buy it, should lay out a list of things that they're going to cover. That, oh, you know what, if you want to have, let's say you get diagnosed with these conditions, sleep apnea, you're going to have to get a pre-certification in order to get a sleep study. You'll have to be a home sleep study, and this is how much we're going to pay for it. You know, these are standard things that you can actually put into your insurance coverage information so people can choose whether they want to do this insurance plan or that. You know, if you know that you have sinus problems or you have problems with, you know, allergies or asthma, whatever, you might want to pick an insurance plan that will cover more ENT-friendly services like balloon sinus dilation or allergy testing. You know, these things should be put out before you actually go to, you know, sign the bottom line. And then you find out your condition isn't covered or you're going to have to, or your medications that you need for that won't be covered. You know, it's all about informed consent. You don't have it throughout the healthcare system. The only people that have to give it are the doctors. And if you're in an independent side, they can go further and tell you the cost of what they're going to do before you do it. But let's talk about the hospital side, because any healthcare law that passes down the road, in order to really affect reform, you will have to make whatever cost is in the system transparent. That is key. If you don't do that, you're going to have this two-tier system that we have already, where it costs people more in the hospital setting, in the corporatized version of healthcare, than it does on the independent side. And it's like the genetically modified labeling situation. The companies that don't want it, don't want it because their products are going to be, they're not going to be chosen. There's people who will become informed consent, I'm sorry, who have who are knowledgeable and know what's on that label will choose against them. It's the same thing in the healthcare system. They don't want you to know how much a CT costs. They don't want you to roll into a hospital and say, you know what, I'm here for a CT or an MRI. Can you tell me how much it's going to cost before I have it done? They never know. They don't tell you. And when they do tell you, it's only partial, like what happened to you when you had your exam, where, you know, you get a colonoscopy, they tell you the price, but you get the bill, it's a different price. That now, I didn't understand exactly why that happened, but now I do. It's because of facility fees. The hospitals are allowed to charge facility fees that they make up. And they affect whether you're in the hospital or whether you're in a doctor's office owned by that hospital. Because once the doctor sells his or her practice, all of their equipment becomes the property of the hospital. And therefore, they can charge a facility fee on it. So your EKGs, which should be nothing, $10 maybe, are $250 or $500 because they have to pay for the EKG machine, which is hospital property.
That's been paid for.
You own the machine, right?
That's been paid for how many years?
That's my point. So you have equipment that's already bought and paid for. They're not paying monthly on it. They own those CT machines and MRIs. They're just gouging. That kind of thing needs to be reined in and addressed. The fact that the administrators in a hospital are 16-to-1 ratio to doctors, what do those guys all do? But they all cost money, but they're not providing a service. My thing is, if you're not providing direct patient care, you should be on the back end of getting paid. The people who run the front line doing it are the valuable parts. But what they've managed to do is monetize doctors. And what I mean by that is, if we don't exist, nobody makes money. It's to correctly write prescriptions, that we see patients, that we actually provide the health care, that everybody is taking their piece, their cut from, inflating the actual pie so they could take more of that cut while they use doctors as the boogeymen up front and say that we're the reason that the prices are so high, and we've allowed that to happen. And it needs to stop. And it's all about patient education. And on that note, we need to take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose, and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. In the break, Dave, my producer, asked about could they use the nuclear option. And I just wanted to clarify that. The fact that they're going to use 51 votes to pass the House legislation, to 51 Senate votes to pass the House legislation, is the nuclear option. That's what Harry Reid did to get things passed. He changed the threshold from 60 to 51. If it's reconciliation, which means you're not adding any new monies, you're not legislating any new changes, you know, big legislative changes into the bill. That's why they can't, or at least they say, and I believe at this point, they can't repeal it because it's new legislation. You need 60. And they can't do a lot of legislative changes because it changes how much money, it changes the budget. That's why they can't do it. Once it's passed, then they can actually start inserting things, and because it's past that reconciliation hurdle, then you can start shoving stuff in. then you have the secretary, HHS secretary, able to strike individual rules and add new ones that are patient friendly, et cetera. So let's talk about what pie in the sky, what we want to see added. You know, I'm not so unhappy, to tell you the truth, that the Tea Party or the conservatives, Rand Paul and the members of Congress who think this is a bad law or will be a bad law and needs it to be more conservative, I agree with them, because what they're trying to do is push it more towards free market. And what is free market? It's kind of a catch-all at this point. But really what it means is the patient will have the power of their pocketbook given back to them. How does that look? Right now they have health savings account written into the law. Health savings accounts means that you can put in the money into a pot, into a bank essentially, that belongs to you, that you get to use for your health care needs. The problem now with that is that it's tied to an insurance company. So you have to have an insurance company administer it. And that means administering it, or administration for them means if we don't allow it, you can't use it. It's ridiculous. So if I want to send a patient for a lab, or we want to do a procedure, and the insurance company denies it because it's, quote, not medically necessary, experimental, whatever, you can't use your health savings account to go around them. Does that make sense to anybody? Of course not. So right now what they've done is they've doubled how much people can put into it, which is great. And the president on his platform wanted health savings accounts to be used like you would have money or wealth. You could put as much money as you wanted into it without any fear of reprisal. You could, if you passed away, pass that same money to your loved ones as wealth. So you can give it between generations, sorry. But the bottom line is, it was wealth that you can control, and you could use it for anything you wanted.
Could it be used for your out-of-pocket on your insurance? I've got to pay $6,500 out-of-pocket before my insurance kicks in, I've got to pay.
Well, actually at this point. But that's what Rand Paul wants to do. He wants to have it be able to be used for your premiums, for your deductibles, co-insurance. And actually, you know what? I'm sorry. You can use it for co-insurance now, right? So if you have $2,500 out of pocket and you have an HSA with $3,000 in it, that $3,000 can be used for your deductibles to pay for that. I'm sorry. You can do that now. But what he wants to do is expand that to paying your premiums. So instead of tax credits, which is technically giving people money and it's an entitlement, or it will be used as that, they want people to be able to have put in as much money as you want over something and then use it to pay for whatever health care need you need it to be used for. Again, that allows patients to be adults and to choose things, you know, make choices that are good for them.
And let it roll over from year to year?
Yeah. Well, I would like that. They don't have that right now. Well, health savings accounts do roll over. As long as you don't empty them, they roll over. I mean, I think that's a good idea, actually. If you don't use your deductible, then if you've put whatever money you put in that didn't come up to the maximum, should roll over to the next year so that you're not having to start over from scratch. I think that's a good idea. I actually wrote that as part of a fix in the book, Big Medicine, that I wrote. So that, again, anything that empowers the patient to not have to keep paying over and over into a system that they're not using is a good thing. If it can be used as savings that you can continue to just pile in, and when something horrible, God forbid, happens, you have a pot of money that you get to decide how it gets used. That's the ultimate goal. So that's what the Freedom Caucus is pushing for. Ban health savings accounts. Use them for anything medical that you decide, if it's holistic, if it's medical tourism, if it's Liberty Health Share, any kind of cost sharing, that's on you. You get to use that money. No one else gets to decide that. I love that. I don't see price transparency in any of it, but I would like to see that on the corporate side, where you make the hospitals list their prices, either by the state database, whatever you like, but they need to have some skin in the game on this. They're not doing anything to lower their prices. As a matter of fact, they keep ramping them up and crying poor at the same time. They're a problem. They need to be addressed. The other thing that I think that would be really helpful is that the free market entities like direct primary care, direct pay practices, again, if you have a health savings account, you get to use those that money to pay for your monthly membership fees. That's saving everybody money instead of taxing, using people's taxes to pay for things. It doesn't make any sense. And separating out the people who are really sick from the general pool. And the lectures that we attended this weekend, I didn't know this, but only 5% of the people who seek health care in our country are the really catastrophically sick, chronically ill people. Only 5%. But they take, you know, they spend about 50% of health care costs go to that 5%. And everybody shares the risk under Obamacare. They don't separate this group out. It just raises the premiums for everybody. It doesn't make a lot of sense. They need to be separated out in a separate risk pool, which would open up the general insurance market to the other general healthy people, and the price would drop for them. It's much easier to cover this group on Medicaid or Medicare, just expand it, and keep that a separate pot than it is to diffuse all that cost throughout the system. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense when you think about it, if you think about it that way. They can still get coverage. Medicaid and Medicare will pick up that side of it. If they start doing some real cost control within their system where they, you know, go outside of the country to try to negotiate better pharmaceutical prices, because that's the main cost, get rid of these facility fees, really equalize the cost of health care between the independent and the corporate health care side, you wouldn't be priced out in Medicaid and Medicare, honestly. I mean, there's all these things that are built into the system. They're not addressing the things that make it expensive. They're just kind of it's kind of a shell game. So right now with the bill, they are pushing before the Ryan, with the Ryan part, before they made the changes, initially, it was going to be a 5-to-1 premium differential between the seniors and the young people, the millennials. I mean, basically just shifted it because it was the opposite way under Obamacare. Now with the new tweaks, they're going to give seniors a tax credit. I think it's $8,000 as you rise in age from 50 up, and it'll be lower for the younger people. I think it's $2,500 tax credit. But again, if you're not working, it's a subsidy. So that's where the Freedom Caucus is getting, I think they're getting kind of entrenched in no more, you know, no more pork for anybody, no more freebies, no more subsidies, no more entitlements, because when you do that, like Medicaid, Medicare, you end up pricing yourself out because, again, the system is designed to continue to get bigger, more money going out, less money coming in. It's not sustainable. It just makes people feel good in the short term. And if you're going to fix the thing, fix it instead of nibbling at it. And so that's it in the big picture.
Do you think, can it be fixed?
Yeah, I do. If we allow the free market side, cost, price transparency, a real competition, patient accountability, and, you know, patients being partners in their care and having control of their own pocketbooks, absolutely, it will change tomorrow. Because there's not a patient in this world, I don't care if they have Medicaid, Medicare, they're the richest people on earth, if they have two, if they're presented with two costs and they can see what they are, they're going to pick the one that's most valuable to them. That's what you want people to be able to do, not be forced to buy a product that's inflated, inferior, and mandated. That's ridiculous. That's why we're in the position that we are. The pharmacy benefit management companies, which I've spoken about ages ago, but I want to revisit that because it's a perfect example of why our system is so poor. If you look at the cost of drugs in Canada, UK, you know, every other developed country, Mexico, they are paying, India, they're paying a fraction of what we're paying in our drugs. And they use some examples, you know, like the drug for hepatitis C, it's like $84,000 a year in our country. It's like $55,000 in Canada. I think it was like 700, something really crazy in India. But the question is, why are we having this differential in the cost. And the drug companies are really honest when you ask them. They are making up the shortfall in all these other discounted countries on the United States. And we're just like, okay, we're not even going to negotiate. We'll just pay what you want. That's how Obamacare was crafted. You use your health savings account to pay the most expensive iteration of whatever. Brand name drugs, you have to, you know, use the most expensive parts of the healthcare system. Otherwise, it won't pay for it. That's a giveaway to an interest who helped craft the bill. One of the answers that we came up with was to benchmark it so that you use the guidelines. Like, our standard of payment will be based on Canada or wherever, the lowest you can get, and use that as our standard. Instead of you being able to tell us which we, you know, give us a bill and we'll pay whatever, we're going to base it on what you're paying elsewhere, what other countries are paying. Isn't that a novel idea? Base it on Canada, pay half. I mean, you probably couldn't get away with basing it on India because we have a different, you know, economic system, but Canada's pretty, you know, apples to apples here, right? Let's see if we can lower our prices based on that, or go to Canada and buy it from them.
On that,
we were told... Oh, I'm sorry. Let's take a break.
Yeah.
You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. I mean, this is no wonder this has gotten to such a crazy level, because it's just so many layers to this. There's so many ancillary players that are feeding at the trough who are really hell-bent on keeping their snout in there while they're doing things to make it, in my opinion, if this doesn't change, or at least as Obamacare has rolled out, harder on doctors. Everything that they said that they were going to do to help us, to help the patient, has had the opposite effect. The electronic medical record system, that thing rolled out under Obamacare in real time. You know, they really wanted to push this high-tech legislation. You had doctors buying in, electronic medical records all over the country. Those in the rural areas were priced out, and they're still not functional. So you spent thousands of dollars, and you can't, if you have a different system than your colleague, you can't send information electronically to them. You can't communicate with each other. You all have to be on the same system in order to do that. Same thing with the hospitals. I mean, there are two basic or the big players in the hospitals. They can't communicate with each other. So we've had all this money being poured into this IT system. And the whole point of it was interoperability, that you can communicate with each other seamlessly. That still hasn't happened. And they're on the third or fourth generation of these things. And all the money that's been poured into it is a waste of money. And this is what I mean. You legislate all of these changes. You don't really let them find a level and actually work before you start putting on more layers and regulations and rules. And ultimately, somebody got rich, but the system still doesn't work. The error rate, which was supposed to go to zero under this, is still not, I think it's higher. Just different kinds of errors, but they're still happening. What's the point of that? It takes doctors longer, especially in the hospital setting, to input their orders than it does before. You just wrote it. Nurses are in a position, and we had, again, intensivists, pediatric NIC and NICU doctors working, or it came to the meeting, saying that when there's a patient that comes in who's an extremist and you need to write an order and get a medication to them, they have to input into a system, have the patient entered into the database. It takes longer to get the necessary medical care to the individual. And this is how bad it is, Dave. They actually have medication carts in the hospital now. Until you input the data for the medication, the drawer will not pop open, so you cannot get the medication. It's locked, literally. This is what's going on in the interest of safety and efficiency and all the things that have gone on. It's the opposite. It takes longer, you're jumping through more hoops. The patient care has been, I think it's slower because you're making one-size-fits-all system. You are putting people on antibiotics, you know, to fight staph infections when they don't have them. So they're going on toxic antibiotics while you get the culture that they may not need, or put them on a vaccination protocol for pneumonia, et cetera, when they don't need it, or they're going to the ICU. Why on earth would you send a debilitated, stricken patient who's going to the ICU? Why do they need a vaccine, which will further, you know, could be, you know, affect their immune system and their ability to heal? All these things are just, who makes these things up? It's toxic. It's expensive. And somebody stands to gain, but it's not really the doctor or the patient.
Dr.
And I'm just saying, isn't that the whole point of our healthcare system?
I don't think you're old enough to remember, but there, many years ago, there was gospel song called "Give Me That Old Time Religion." Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that or not, but
I do.
I think it applies to, or my feeling at my age is, "Give me that old time doctor." You know, the term hospitalist sends cold chills down my body. You go into the hospital, your doctor doesn't follow you. You've got somebody you've never seen before. He or she is totally relying on what you love, what you just talked about, electronic medical records that might or might not know that you have a crooked smile. Who knows? But mm-hmm. you're with someone that has no clue about who you are, isn't going to follow you, assuming you get out of the hospital. They're not going to follow you out of the hospital. So, you know, I'm ready to get the old-time medicine. I want my doctor to go with me to the hospital, whether it's my cardiologist or my gastroenterologist or whatever ologist it is. I would like them to go to the hospital with me.
I agree, and I think that they would like it as well, but they are locked out of that system, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a cookie-cutter template that's being used in the healthcare system with veterinarians. I found out as I picked up my pet yesterday that the vets who work for the corporate, pet care, Petco, et cetera, they actually have to follow an algorithm guideline. So the pet comes in. They have they take the symptoms down, they enter into the computer spits out the diagnosis and the treatment plan, and those vets have to write the right medication. If they go against it, they get an email the next day asking them why they didn't do X, and if they do it a couple more times, they're out in their butt. You know what? The same thing happens in the medical system. The same thing happens in the hospital. You have to follow the algorithms, the decision tree that the Watson IBM brain is coming up with. That's what they're trying to make people believe, that doctors are fallible, overly so. We're all human, of course we are, but a computer can make a diagnosis better than a doctor. But a doctor just needs to be the person that completes the recommendations of the computer. Well, what kind of nonsense is that? And so they're saying they diagnose faster, they diagnose more efficiently, they're usually right more times than a doctor, but there's no empathy, there's no individuality, there's no, their art of medicine is being stripped away. And I don't personally take the belief that that's better. I don't. Because when you're on the outside looking in and you have a diagnosis or you have something that's complicated and the computer can't get there, you need someone who's going to sit with you, your family, and make decisions that are best for you. That doesn't happen in this system. You're going down the pathway, the logic pathway of hospice or no surgery or there's no reason to spend money because it's not worth it. That's the path that you end up going down. And for those people who think that's a good thing, I wonder if they'll think that when they're on that side of the equation. And, it doesn't cost any less, right? And if we were so concerned about cost, we would fix things that are causing the system to be so expensive in the first place. It's like whack-a-mole. You fix one thing, and then something else goes off. It's unintended consequences. But I'm going to be a little bit cynical because I think the Obamacare law was written exactly the way and implemented and had an outcome exactly what they wanted it to be. Ruin healthcare. Take away the private insurance market, make the government control it, or have the government control it by administrators, these insurance companies. Everything's gone from dozens to a few. It's become a monopoly, corporatized, centralized, and as you do this, you capture the doctors by giving them no options in terms of being independent. You have the patient stuck in these health plans where they have little choice. Next thing you know, you control the whole situation, and then you bring in single payer. That's the ultimate goal. I still believe it. This is not, it's better than that because it allows people to escape. But I don't want to do something as a negative. I want it to be a positive, that you choose something because it's the best thing for you, not because it's the worst, the best of all worst choices. That's not what we all want. I know that's not what patients want or physicians. I can't speak to anybody else. But the bottom line is we have to take our power back. I'm hoping that this law, I mean, everything that's bad about it seems to be popping up now before they send this for vote. Hopefully they'll be able to clean out more bad things and incorporate the things that actually do empower the doctor and patient. I think the Freedom Caucus is important. They're providing a service to everybody right now by holding people to the fire. I want our healthcare system to be fixed, but I'm not willing to make it kind of better for the short term when it falls right back off the cliff on the long term. I'm not about getting reelected in 2 years. I just want my patients to have choice, and I want to stay open, and I want to love what I do. I think every doctor and every patient in the country feels the same way about that. How we get there is the problem. So hopefully that I shed a little light on what's going on. It's not as simple. It's not an easy process, but you need to stay engaged, honestly, and stay positive. And if this doesn't work for you, the only good thing that will happen is you'll be able to leave. Actually, you know what? You can leave it now because the executive order from the president has already gotten rid of the fines and the taxes, and you can leave your insurance without waiting for the Congress to help you. So that's one positive. So on that note, I think we need to end the show. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call, and have a wonderful week.
Thank you, Dr. George.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.